All right, hey, it's Dave Wilbur, and I'm just trying to kind of work out the technical details here. So welcome to the TurfNet Renovation Report. I'm your host, Dave Wilbur, today. We're sponsored today by Golf Preservations and by Jacobson, and super, super excited to be here. And just I've been looking forward to this, as my guest today is such an amazing and interesting guy. And just want to introduce Armin Suni. Armin, are you there? Have I got you?
Dave, I am here, and it's good to be here with you today. And I'm so happy that TurfNet has seen fit to put you on the air. I think it's a great thing, and a lot more great things to come in the future for you.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Thanks, Armin. I really appreciate that. So, look, who is Armin Suni?
Yeah, that's a good question.
If somebody doesn't know it now, you know, we're going to get to how I know you, but who is Armin? Somebody doesn't know you. How do you introduce yourself?
I can't really think of any good way other than, I mowed my first green 43 years ago, and I've been doing something in golf ever since. And I've done a lot of things, Dave, as you know, but the listeners don't know. Grew up in Philadelphia, was hitchhiking home from the driving range chip and putt when I was 14 or 15 years old. Some old guy picked me up, Dave. He's probably 45 years old, Max Glantz. Turns out Max was the green chairman at White Manor. And by the time I got out of the car, I had a job there. Max went on to be the green chairman at White Manor for 25 years. And it was amazing run. And I worked for Steve Campbell there, and Steve went to Aronimink, and so I followed him there. And after 2 years of thinking I was going to be the world's best freestyle skier and not cashing enough checks, I thought I'd better go to school. So so I went to Penn State. Steve Campbell helped me get in. And, obviously Joe Deutsch was there. And those great years, Tom Watsky, Don Waddington, probably at that point in time, the best education a young fellow could have. And as a Pennsylvania resident, didn't cost me much. Went from there to Murray and Golf Club, worked for Richie Valentine, which it doesn't get any better than that. And at 22 years old.
For people who don't know Richie Valentine, and I don't know who doesn't know Richie, but just in case you don't know Richie, I mean, his father, Joe, was the superintendent before him, right? So,
and the construction. Right. Joe Valentine was construction foreman for William Flynn.
Yeah, exactly. So, what a cool spot to step into. So you were Richie's assistant?
Yeah, in the days right out in of the day. Yeah, I was 22 in the days of one assistant and a major championship coming. He basically threw me the keys. And there it was. Baptism by fire. We had a US Open there, 4 inches of rain during the Open. Matt knows what that's like. Matt Schaefer does. Had a car drive on greens during the Open, spin out. I mean, just a remarkable experience for a young guy. And so Richie to me was really, Joe Deutsch and Richie Valentine, great mentor, Steve Campbell. And so I got my first job at Rolling Green Golf Club, right after the Open. You're as hot as you're ever going to be. And so at the age of 23, I got the job at 23, 24, something like that. I don't know. 25, maybe. I don't know what it was. So I got the job at Rolling Green, was there a couple of years, and then I got the call to go to Cherry Hills. Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. And you were 26 when you got the call to go to Cherry Hills. Yeah. And they were having a little event there, weren't they?
Yeah. Well, I'd done an amateur at Aronimink in 77. And then we did the Open at Murray, and I was the assistant there. And during that time, Richie took good care of me, introduced me to George Fazio, Frank Hannigan, who was the executive director of the USGA at the time, needed to go someplace. So Richie had me take him. Richie was looking out for me. And so I get the call from Joe Deutsch and from Penn State, and Billy Buchanan, who was had been with the championship agronomist with the USGA and with the tour. Both of them called me within a day, telling me the Cherry Hills job was open and I should apply. Mm-hmm. And so I I call up Mr. Hannigan, as I called him in those years, Frank Pastor.
Frank Hannigan.
Yes, executive director of USGA. You know, just as a young guy, I called him up and explained to him who I was, and he said he remembered from our drive around the golf course. And I asked him if he would write a letter of support for me for the Cherry Hills job, not knowing that the general manager at Cherry Hills, Joe Vincent, another mentor of mine, knew Hannigan very well, and Jim Hand, who had been past president of the USGA. So Hannigan writes this letter, which I don't see until years later when Joe Vincent gave it to me, that said, Frank said, I don't know if he could grow grass, but he ran the U.S. Open at Marion. And if you knew Frank's humor, that fits right in it. And so I ended up getting the job, and had a PGA championship there, which I think was the first time that the U.S. golfers had purposefully been exposed to firm and fast golf in a championship.
Okay, so I just want to back up for a second. You're 26 years old, and you have your second superintendent's job, and now at Cherry Hills Country Club, and you're hosting the PGA Championship, right?
Yeah, I think I was 27 by then, yeah.
Okay, 27 by the tournament. And walking into Denver, you know, knew the climate a little bit, probably from skiing, but not necessarily from growing grass. And it was your decision to, kind of decide to knock off the water. And, you know, I remember you telling me one time that you went 12 days without watering just to see what would happen.
I did that in the summer of 84, my first summer there. I just turned the sprinklers off to see how it would react, just so I could plan for the following year.
Right.
And and everybody freaked out. But I also, Dave, at the same time, I had I added 10,000 square foot of green surface, putting surface back to the greens. No master plans, no architects. I just, it's a Flynn golf course. I knew where the greens are supposed to be. It wasn't real.
Sure, you go poke around, you find the old greens, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, you could see it. It was sitting there. All the little beautiful nooks and crannies and organic movements just had disappeared. And so, we turned the water off and everybody freaked out. And then I turned it back on and it all turned green and they all kind of relaxed a little bit. But
one real quick thing about Cherry Hills, from what I remember, and I remember this very well, is Lee Trevino really went after you, didn't he?
Yeah, Jack did as well.
It was personal, huh?
Yeah, well, I mean, we all took it. I was young and full of it. And, in hindsight, I probably would have handled it slightly differently. But, I called everybody out on it as well. And,
we were talking about is the place got firm and dry. And if, was it the 18th fairway there?
Yes.
If you didn't put your shot in the right place, it was going to run down the hill and be off the fairway, right? And Trevino didn't like that.
Yeah, David, Ed Miller was working for me then, and we had cut the fairways at a quarter inch all year. So, and Ed says they stimped at 7, but they were never 7. They were just, mid to high 6s. And we would sit out on number 10 and putt into the back pin position on number 10 from 150 yards out. It was a blast. But, the PGA of America, we had disagreed about the speed of the greens a year before. The president of the club was kicking me under the table to shut up, which I wasn't good at. And, but
who's good at shutting up when they're 27? Yeah.
Yeah. So the first 2 days we gave them the speeds they wanted, guys shot lights out. So day three, or Friday night, I see the PGA of America guys at, and we ended up being buddies, years later. But I saw them at the hotel and I said, guys, you had it 2 days your way. Tomorrow it's my way. Mm-hmm. And they said, what? I said, well, the greens are going to be fast. And we just, rolled the greens and we hadn't watered them. So things got a little bounce. A ball would bounce 5-6 feet high on the green. But a big deal to me. But
like a basketball back in your hand. Sure. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that all blew up. And, but it all worked out in the end and, championship went pretty well. Hubie Green won, and interesting enough, Hubie had been the assistant superintendent at Marion in 1971 when they had an open there.
What?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
and had not qualified for the Open there. Yeah. So we had a little Murrayan connection going. And
Hubert Greene was a grass guy. No kidding. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So Hubie, interesting. So, but what everybody, you know, the media was much nicer in those days, at least to the players.
Yeah.
And so nobody mentioned that Trevino, there was a little thunderstorm going on south of the club, probably over South Suburban Dave, where he used to be years ago. And Trevino heard that. He was running for the clubhouse. I don't think in those last three holes he cared what he did. He was just heading for the clubhouse. He heard that, and they were trying to get it done before they had to call rain delay. Uh-huh. And so I still to this day contend that if there hadn't been a thunderstorm, Lee would have probably won.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so maybe true.
Yeah. So maybe that was it. And then from there, I went to Castle Pines and, you know, we did six internationals there, and I ended up at that point in time, I was running the country club course as well. And that's where I first met Dick Copland, who, you know, I do searches with now. Mm-hmm. We did some events there, and then I ended up doing a year as the tournament director there, which was pretty interesting.
Wow.
And
so from superintendent to tournament director, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, my title was vice president of agronomy. Everybody wanted to know who the president was. I don't think we had a president of agronomy, but Jack Vickers, I suppose. Right.
Right. The owner was the president.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. And from there, I went out and tried to do a golf course residential development, spent a couple of years trying to do that. Didn't get it across the finish line. So Larry Rogers had the great irrigation designer had introduced me to the people from the Mirage.
Uh-huh.
And so I ended up going out to work for Steve Wynn in Las Vegas as a general manager at Shadow Creek. And and so I think to this day, it's probably the first time a superintendent was hired, you know, having never been a GM at a great club, you know, so, so that's kind of interesting, but yeah. I spent 5 years there until Steve got knocked out with a hostile takeover by Kirk Kerkorian.
Right. The MGM people took over. You know.
That's right. Yeah. 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 And then from there, went back to Denver and had an interest in some real estate projects that we got 9/11 on. You know, 9/11 came along and knocked us out. But luckily, the owners did just fine on the deal. And, you know, and from there, Richard Zokel, my good friend, called me up one day and told me about a project, a dream that he had had all these years. He wanted to build a golf course. And, you know, Dave, I don't know if you remember, but 1989, I think it was, I get a call during the international. I get a call that somebody wants to meet me. So I go up and get introduced to Richard Zokel. Okay. And he's going to do 36 holes of Nicklaus Golf in the Vancouver area. Dick's from Vancouver originally.
Right. Right. He's Canadian. Yeah.
Yep. So, the deal, the government changes, they ban golf on ag land up there and the deal craters, but we established a friendship and we've been friends ever since. Mm-hmm. So, and I knew Dick was trying to put a deal together. So he calls me, and I think it's 06, he calls me, maybe 05, and says he's got a deal put together and he wants me involved. So this is funny. So I go ahead and say, well, Dick, you know, I'll need to, you know, source some materials for you. I'll need to, you know, figure out the irrigation. I'll need to do this and that. So it's probably X amount of days that you'll need me, you know, and this is what it'll cost you. Mm-hmm. And he goes, I want you there more than that. I go, well, you don't need me more than that.
Right.
You know, that's more than that. Yeah. Yeah. That's going to be enough time. And he said, well, he goes, let me talk, which, you know, for me is tough, Dave. So I said, okay.
No. Really?
So he said, here's what I want to do. He goes, I want you to be a co-designer with me and Rod Whitman.
Okay.
I said, Rod, I'm in. Yeah. So
yeah. Took you all of 4 seconds to think of that answer. Huh.
Yeah. And sure. And so I don't know that he ever told Rod up front that that was the deal.
Right, exactly.
But
so listen, we're going to take a short break here, and when we come back, I want to get into that a little bit. I want to get into your transition to architecture. Okay. So, hang on. And, you're listening to the TurfNet Renovation Report, sponsored by Jacobson and Golf Preservations. And we'll be right back with Armin Suni.
From greens drainage to sod work, Golf Preservations can handle your project with ease and give you the peace of mind to know the professionals are caring for your valuable golf course assets. Visit golfpreservations.com or call 606-499-2732 to talk to us directly about your next project.
You're listening to the TurfNet Renovation Report, and this is Dave Wilbur, your host today. I'm one of the bloggers for TurfNet, and suddenly thrown into the job of hosting this thing, which I'm pretty stoked about, and I'm really stoked about the fact that I have Armin Suni here. And Armin has been telling us about his past and all that stuff, and telling us about his work with Richard Zuckel, and so... Arm, I want to get right to it here, and I want to start talking about this whole area, because this is the Renovation Report, and I love that you and Zuckel did some new stuff and everything, but I also know that you've done some restoration renovation work, and the first question that I want to ask you today is if you can maybe talk a little bit about the philosophy of design that you and Rich Zuckel are holding on to these days. I think it's kind of unique, and by the way, if you want to know a little bit more about that too, the website for Zuckel Design is listed. The Anarchist Guide to Golf Design is listed as well on the page here. So you can get to that from the link if you want to learn more. But Arm, I'd love it if you'd talk philosophy with me for just a second.
Well, yeah. You know, I grew up on great golf courses, Dave. And at one point, I figured I'd spent 40,000 hours on great golf courses, seeing every kind of golf shot imaginable hit. And Dick's played every great golf course there is. So between us, we have a very interesting perspective on golf course design. And I marvel at the fact that golf course designers, their main course of study is to look at the great old golf courses. Instead of studying golfers' habits first and nature first, these two things should ultimately be before you think about the great golf courses. Study nature, what nature really looks like and is, and study golfers and how they play the game. And I don't mean just the guys playing the back tees that are the plus handicaps or single.
Right. Team. Which golfers? I mean, everybody. Which golfer do you study? Everybody. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how many golf shots you think I've seen hit in 40,000 hours on great golf courses. Probably a few. And I challenge anybody in the design business to say they've seen more golf shots hit than me, because they haven't. And
yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing about being having a superintendent's background is you get to watch a lot of golf, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
We spend a lot of time watching people hit the ball, you know, as turf people. So, sure, I understand exactly what you're saying.
And you know, I grew up with, you know, for working for Richie Valentine, where we renovated the bunkers. I ran a bunker renovation in 1980 at Murrayan and knew absolutely nothing about it. You know, Richie waved his hands. The old Italian guys with the great pose knew what to do. We'd go over to hang out with Eb Steiniger at Pine Valley. Eb was the superintendent at Pine Valley 50 years, and he'd show us what he had done over the years, what worked, what didn't work. You know, an education by accident. But So Dick and I have a philosophy that's very interesting. And I'll never forget, we're out with Rod Whitman looking at sagebrush, and Rod's talking about this shot he wants to create. And Dick owns the project at this point. He's, you know, he's the managing partner. And Dick says, hey, Rod, I can hit that shot 1 out of 10 times. We're not going to do that. And it showed me something. And the reason that there's a set of forward tees there that's like 4,700 yards and they're right on the fairway most of the time is because Dick wanted the lesser golfer to be able to go out and have fun. And so that's been our philosophy, is to create a golf course that's immensely playable for average players and lesser players, but to give the better players a physical and, more importantly, a mental challenge to where they have options and they have to think about things. And so that's the basis of our design. You know, we're nature-based. We look around us to come up with forms and shapes. We don't just put these little corridors in of these golf features that we fancy. We try to bring in what's outside the property and develop something special that's congruent with the surroundings and nature.
Sure. Makes perfect sense. So, okay, so frame that a little bit in the existing golf course renovation, restoration type.
Well, you know, so, we're working with, really with Brian Metz.
Sometimes can.
Yeah, we're working with Brian Metz at the Presidio. And, you know, funny how these
things
happen. The
Presidio in San Francisco, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, wonderful property.
Great course in San Francisco and a wonderful guy, Brian. So what a cool thing there.
Yeah, and he's got a great general manager, Don Chelomidis, and Don's done such a great job because we're funding it out of operations. So it's been slow going, but Brian's been doing most of the shaping, and he's been doing most of the stuff in-house, and it's been very good for us and for Brian, I think, this kind of collaborative effort. And Don jumps in the middle of it as well. We don't have all the answers. We don't know the golf course as well as they do. So we take that input. And between the four of us, Dick, Brian, Don, myself, we hash these things out. And, you know, we do it differently. You know, we do clay models of the greens and the green surrounds and the bunkering. We do charcoal drawings of these things. And Zokol can do it all himself as well. You know, he's right in there with it. And that's how we work with our hands in the dirt. But, well, clay for the models, obviously.
Clay.
But so it's a whole it's a throwback to old style of doing things, and we think it fits. But ultimately, what we've tried to do, Dave, as we do that, is to keep it very playable for your average golfers, but to give those great golfers a challenge. You know, instead of the back tee being the highest tee at every golf course you go to, right? We slip that back tee down to a lower elevation when we can, and change the angle, give them the tougher angle.
Right, because at a place like the Presidio, it's not like you're going to go find ground around it. I mean, some of the most expensive real estate in the country, all around the place. So you're not going to go find another 100 yards to lengthen something. So that's the kind of stuff that you have to look at, right?
Yeah, and to have, you know, to have a talented shaper as a superintendent, I mean, it's just wonderful. And Don's had some great thoughts conceptually about design, and so we get in there and we work with everybody, and it's I think it's been very well accepted. And what we did, Dave, is we talked about the fact that it had to be consistent with the era, and you know, Fowler had been on the property. So we kind of use a Simpson Fowler feel to things, more Simpson really, and try to emulate that style, not to any exacting standards because so many people have touched the property, but certainly to capture an era of design and to put that on the ground. And we think we're doing okay at it. Yeah, we can always do better, and that's what we hope to do as we continue. We're half done at this point.
And because you're funding the thing out of operations, it's not gonna be close and do it all at once, right?
No, it's kind of fun. And Dave, you know, as much as we all know, and if you've read some of my stuff, that runoff areas are an invention of modern golf, that there weren't runoff areas when they cut fairways at an inch or an inch and a quarter. They were intermediate height and the ball didn't roll off. But we've used some of those runoff areas because your average golfer and lesser golfer, when put on short grass, has all kinds of options that he feels much better about than he does playing out of the sand. And your better golfer would always rather be in a bunker, a sand trap, to be able to hit his perfect explosion shot, which he can hit, you know, get up and down, you know, half the time. So that's been one of our concepts and why we've strayed a bit, but from real convention of the golden era of design.
Right. Well, that makes sense. And you mentioned that Brian is a talented shaper. And So in your situation there, it's easy for you to just say, hey, this is what I want, and he can get it done without having to call somebody else in or schedule around somebody else's project or whatever. You can get it done in-house with that.
Yeah, and for some reason, he makes it better than we ever thought it could be. So, I mean, that's really, you know, people don't really talk about it, but, you know, shapers are what really make a golf course great. And the architects can take all the credit they want, but if they're not there shaping the whole thing, the credit should be shared, certainly.
Well, and you mentioned Rod Whitman, and for a lot of people who don't know Rod, he's pretty handy with the dozer, isn't he?
He is, yeah. And, you know, it was funny because Whit used to, every time I'd show up, I'd be there every other week. And so as soon as I'd show up, Whit would take off because he didn't want to listen to anything I had to say, which is pretty funny. We still laugh about it. Ultimately, you know, our role in this, Dave, you have as a superintendent and all the superintendents listening have had to fix things on new renovations and new constructions for the first couple of years. We all know that.
Absolutely. Absolutely so, true.
So my goal with our first construction job of Sagebrush was to minimize that. And we really didn't have to go in and fix anything. It worked the way we put it on the ground, which I think I was proud of. And I know Rod was too. He said it was the most complete golf course he'd ever done. So I think we did a lot, and it was fun way.
Big statement from Rod there. That's cool. All right, let's spend a couple minutes talking about the superintendent's role in renovation. And we've been talking about Brian, and Brian's ego is going to need a big deflation thing here from all this. But I want you to talk to me a little bit about what makes a successful superintendent on the ground in a renovation process.
Probably the biggest thing is attitude, Dave. You know, when you have somebody with a positive can-do attitude involved in any project, things just get better, you know, because problems are less of a problem. There are always problems at every construction job there is. There's always, you find something you didn't know was underground. You find potential to do something even better because once you start stirring it up, you see something in the field and all the great golf courses react to that. And so having a superintendent that's there and understands and is going to have to live with everything, you know, it's very important. And superintendents have a lot of sway in, you know, who's chosen for design jobs. So they're very important to us.
Just a second.
Yeah.
You know, so here's the superintendent, and suddenly he's been told, hey, we're going to hire an architect, or, you know, or he's decided he's in over his head. And now it's time to hire somebody, and a short list is developed. Maybe it starts as a long list and then it's a short list, and eventually some architects are going to come and visit. And superintendent has a major influence at that point, doesn't he?
He really does, because quite often the committee will look to him to reach out to peers who've done projects with those architects and get some feedback.
What's going on in the neighborhood and golf is always important. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they have much more sway in the matter than they ever think they do.
That's an amazing comment. Much more influence than they think they do. And yet I can't tell you how many superintendents have told me in a renovation situation that they feel like the train is just running away from them, you know? And I think part of that has to do with the fact that they still got to maintain the golf course, you know, through all these conversations. The truth is they all have a lot more influence than they think they do. I would agree with that.
Yeah, and depending on the scope of the project and the skill of the staff, and by that I mean, you know, the assistants or the other employees, you know, they may need to bring in a project manager to help them through that, or you know, maybe they don't need one. But it's certainly something they all must consider, because first and foremost, they want to ensure that when the project's over, they still have a job, and that they've done the best they can for their club. And put the ego aside, and if there's somebody that you can hire that can do it better than you, hire them. I mean, that's what you're there for. You're there to help the club, help steer them in the right direction.
I agree completely. Armin, we're going to take a short break, and I'm here on the TurfNet Renovation Report with Armin Suni. of SUNY Zocal Design and some other things. We're talking about renovation, restoration, golf course superintendents, grass, all that sort of thing. So we'll be right back with more good stuff.
TurfNet's Renovation Report is brought to you by Jacobson, makers of the all-new Truckster XD, a true heavy-duty utility vehicle with the largest standard payload capacity in its class. The all-new Jacobson Truckster XD is designed to make your next renovation, or whatever your next big project is, easier.
And you're listening to the TurfNet Radio Renovation Report. I'm your host, Dave Wilbur, today, one of the bloggers for TurfNet and part of the team there. You know, and just a shout out real quick to an amazing guy, John Kiger, who is, he describes himself as the ad guy for TurfNet. But man, does he have great ideas, and this is one of them. John came up with the idea to do a renovation report, talk to some superintendents, architects, builders, and all those sorts of things, and really get into that, because right now that seems to be the work that is going on, is renovation and restoration work. And everybody tells me that we're not going to build as much new stuff, which I think is probably a good thing, but the taking care of what we got, it's a huge business. Would you agree, Armin?
Dave, I really would. And you know, as you know, Dick Zocal and I hung up our shingle right into the crash, and you know, and we're competing against all the big guys and getting our heads handed to us most of the time. But you know, a few crumbs fall off the table, and we sweep those up as best we can. So, you know, I've really been spending a lot of my time recently, Dave, you know, working with Dick Coplin and Kirk Keebler, Coplin and Keebler, doing superintendent, general manager searches, golf professional searches. And, you know, the amazing thing is I get to go see all these great golf courses again and see places as part of what I'm doing. And it's just a wonderful experience.
Oh, that's a cool thing. And inside of all that, probably you're going to hear a lot from the committee members and all that sort of stuff about what they want their facilities to be, right?
Yeah, you start to get even a better feel for the, you know, where the members are coming from about their properties and what they see and what they want. We certainly need to know that about finding the right candidates for the right positions, because it's always about getting, obviously, all the technical issues right, as far as, you know, skill sets, but to getting the culture right. And it's the same culture that when we deal with golf course renovation projects and design projects, we have to get that culture right too. You know, we have to understand what green speeds they're expecting, to understand what slopes we can put on greens. What a novel concept. Come up with your green speeds before you design the golf course.
Imagine that. Wow. It makes sense to the turf guys, but not so much sometimes does translate to the architects.
Yeah. So, you know, so working with Coplin and Keebler, which I've been doing for 15 years now, is, you know, has really been fun. And it's been keeping me very busy so far. But hey, Dave, we haven't talked about the Open yet. I think we need to talk about that, don't we?
Oh, man. I know a lot of people have been sitting here waiting, right? They're like, when are they ever going to talk about the Open? And, well, you know what? Armin, you go first.
Okay. you know, Dave, I made a preemptive strike for the guys at Chambers Bay on, I think, Tuesday or Wednesday. I put out a blog post explaining why there were going to be difficulties with the greens and how those guys have done their absolute best with the hand they were dealt. I did a little weather research and looked at the highest average temperature in St. Andrews. And the highest it gets, the average temperature, the hottest day of the year, 66.
Hottest day of the year in St. Andrews, Scotland, 66.
Average is 66 degrees for the high.
Okay, for the average. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. There's 4 months in Tacoma, Washington, where it's over that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
At Bandon Dunes, that number's, I think it was 68 degrees.
Okay.
So there's probably 3 months in Tacoma where it's hotter than the highest day at Bandon Dunes. So the fine fescue was going to be on the edge of its adaptation and being successful. So you add a tough year into that. And those mm-hmm. true annual type poets, and nobody talked about this, Dave, the different kinds of poa and why we were looking at that ugly annual poa. And as every turf guy out there knows, the first poa that shows up.
Nobody talked about this because most of them don't even know how to say poa, you know, in the media.
Yeah, poa. Yeah.
Listen, yeah.
Edgar Allan Poe. Yeah.
Yeah, Poe. You know, yeah. So then, you know, you melt their brains with annual types and perennial types, and Jesus, you know, nothing good comes out of that. So,
well, and we know, Dave, it takes 10 or 15 years. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're watching the television and you're starting to see those annual types flourish a little bit. Huh?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Doing what they do when they're under stress, putting as much seed out as they can.
Right. Help. I'm trying to save my life. Help. Help.
Yeah, sure. We need to continue our species here, and I'm going to put as much seed out there as I can before I die. That's what they do inherently, and I think that the USGA, and I'm going to go there, that the USGA once again struggles with irrigation management in championships.
You think?
and the dry down is not 3 weeks before the event when you have some poe in the greens. The dry down is the Thursday before. That's enough time to get them good and firm. You don't need any more time than that. And at that point, you could have kept that poe. Maybe, I don't know, Dave, but I think it probably would have not wigged out quite as much.
Well, there obviously seems to be a big discrepancy, you know, between a lot of, I mean, I've talked to some people that were on the ground there and certainly had some interactions with Josh Lewis. And first of all, my hats are off to those guys. I mean, look, championship golf.
They did great.
Yeah. They did great. And the volunteers and everybody that were involved there, I mean, we never want to take away from those guys. But, you know, what startled me the most, Armin, about this whole thing is how little the media and the golf writers and everybody, you know, except for Brad Klein. Like, Brad gets it.
Sure.
You know, he's nearly a turf head, isn't he? But I can't believe how many media people, and I'm talking about media people that ought to know, not just, you know, somebody who's been covering baseball and suddenly, hey, let's go to the U.S. Open, but media people that really ought to know who just weren't prepped on what that surface was about and why it was there and the whole thing. I mean, they just didn't have enough knowledge coming into the thing. You know, that was my thought. I was startled by the lack of real information that had come to them.
Yeah, I thought Brad was good. I thought Ron Reed did a good job all through it all too.
He sure did. He sure did. Absolutely. And but you know, there were some others that were just like, really? I mean, this is what you think. And this whole, you know, I think, and I'm going to go there now, I think that what you saw was a glimpse into what the golf business may look like in 20 years.
I think the biggest issue I have with that is that, as we know, stressed turf takes a beating from any kind of vehicular traffic.
From anything. That's right. From anything. Right.
Exactly. And if we're gonna run golf cars, we cannot take grass to the limit like that. You got to back off at some point because it'll take weeks to recover.
That's really true. And let me qualify my remarks a little bit about the 20-year thing. I guess what I'm saying is that golf courses are not going to get to use the kind of inputs that they're using today. I mean, water, as we well know, is a big issue. I don't think we're going to see more pesticides. There's going to be less. And I think as you see people, you know, that live near the golf course having to watch the length of time that they shower, they're not going to be good with sprinkler heads running, you know, while they're not getting to shower. So there's a change afoot, wouldn't you say?
Well, I mean, I've always felt that way, that, you know, I've always liked organic type fertilizers and microbe friendly fertilizers and letting the microbes and the grass breathe between irrigations. Mm-hmm. So that less frequent irrigation and more natural maintenance levels, always something, you know, Dave, as you know, that we've always been very interested in.
Right. Absolutely. So let's talk about fescue for a second. You know, can a fescue putting surface be a great putting surface in your opinion?
Oh, I've seen some great stuff, but I think... Yeah, I think the climate's, you know, like anything, like we're not going to put ultra dwarfs, Brandon Chambly, we're not going to put ultra dwarfs out there because they're not climatically adapted to that. And I think we were absolutely on the edge of fine fescues being climatically adapted to Chambers Bay.
Well, the numbers support
for the greens. Yeah.
Yeah, for the greens. Exactly. I think, you know, for the fairways and everything else. But you may be right about that because the numbers that you put up on your blog. And if you haven't checked out Armin's blog, you can just simply search The Anarchist Guide to Golf Design. Where did you come up with the anarchist thing?
I don't know. You know, I get these crazy random thoughts and it popped out. And that's what I went with. It seemed to describe how most people think of my philosophies.
Uh-huh. So yeah. You're an anarchist at heart in some fashion, you know.
Yeah,
it's about, you know, doing something different, right?
Is that doing what you think's right and creative thought processes, you know, to me that's, and if that's anarchy, I mean, that's, I guess that's what I am. But I remember having discussions with Bill Corr, Ben Crenshaw, and I think Tom Mead was in the deal too, about Sandhills way back when they were going to go with fescue on the fairways up there.
Tom Mead, one of my favorite turf guys ever.
Yeah, you know? smart guy.
smart guy. And a great skier to boot.
And I remember having those discussions and saying, listen, guys, I have no problem with planting fine fescues on fairways in the Sandhills of Nebraska. What I have a problem with is using wimpy European varieties. Because I don't think they're tough enough when we have all these great, great varieties that have been bred, you know, in Oregon, basically. And mm-hmm. and I think would hold up better. Now, I was wrong in that I thought summer was going to be the issue, not winter. And as we know, winter became the big issue there.
Winter is the issue, right?
Yeah. But I was wrong about that. But
when you've got sand and wind and cold temperatures and not a ton of snow, what happens?
Yeah.
Nothing good. Nothing
good. Desiccation city, yeah. And but I think that if we had used, if the guys at that point had used some American varieties, some tougher ones, that it probably would have held up a little bit better. And mm-hmm. but you know, so I think fescues, and as you know, Dave, you helped me with the selection of grasses for sagebrush, and we went with a fescue brown top up there, and mm-hmm. I've grown to hate brown top, but that's another right. story.
Well, we've learned a lot about brown top, haven't we? And
yes. You know, colonial bankgrass when I was working to everybody. Yeah,
colonial bent, right? And you know, the different variety. I mean, there's such a big difference in what's produced from cultivar to cultivar, and we don't get the good stuff in the States. We really don't. Most of the good stuff goes to the UK and sent other places. So it's really hard to source the seed, but yeah, I think we're seeing away from the brown top. I mean, I'm just going back to Walter Woods telling me in Scotland that we had to use it, you know, because I was thinking, why don't we just do fescue? But I thought that for a second, and then I got my ass handed to me, pardon the French. But and you know, when one of the world's most famous greenkeepers is the one doing the handing, you shut up, you know, if you want to, you know, I spoke up quietly individually to him, but in amongst the group of people that were working on that project, I learned my lesson. Be quiet. Let the famous people speak, you know? So, hey, speaking of that, I want to ask you, what do you do? You've been in so many of these committee situations, both in the search end of it, in the new construction and all that. What do you do with that one or two guys who are difficult people?
Well, you know,
the guy that thinks he knows it all, right, at the committee.
Well, I think, you know, I'm going to go back to something that William Flynn talked about, and I touched on briefly, is that, you know, in these situations, sometimes it is a collaborative decision, and you can make better decisions collaboratively. Now, some of these people are distractions to the process, and typically as an employee, you have to be very, very careful about how you deal with it. And you have to work through your committee chair or somebody else to be able to deal with those situations. And you might be able to guide the process while you stay in the shadows. From the search side, like, you know, I've been with Dick Copland many times. where Dick just really calls people out and tells them the way it is, because, you know, he's done, I don't know, close to 1,000 searches probably. So, and he knows, and when he tells people and explains that to them, they usually defer, just like we've seen committee members defer to the very well-known architects before, you know, in meeting situations. So I think really from the superintendent's perspective, they've got to manage that situation very well. And they have to be a little bit of a political animal to know how to do that. It's a skill you can learn. So
that's right.
If they work at it, they can do it. They can read about it. They can visit with other superintendents that are very successful politically, who might not be as good at grass growers as they are, but survive better. It's interesting. Right. Because it's a complete skill set that, you know, we're always looking for on the superintendent and the GM side. But those skill sets, communication-wise, are very, very important.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you touched on something a while back, and let's go back to it, which is the idea that you're an employee. You know, the golf course superintendent is an employee, and there are things that you can and cannot say. But you can get somebody to send those messages, correct?
That's how you have to do it. Now, you know, obviously, you know, I worked for Richie Valentine, who would say it out loud, but, you know, his family had been running the golf course at that point for, you know, 75 years. So he had standing, but most people, you know, and I worked for Joe Vincent at Cherry Hills. Joe had standing. He would say what needed to be said, but when he could, and other times he used the political mechanisms that he had at his fingertips.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes part of that political mechanism, Armin, and you know, you and I, let's be full disclosure about this. We make a little bit of our livings doing these things, but bringing in a consultant to help you send that message is not necessarily a mark of weakness, is it?
Well, no, if you can find somebody that can help you get to where you want to go and to get the club to someplace that's in a better place, you're silly not to use whatever tools you have at your disposal.
That's right.
Your ego should be goal-oriented as opposed to self-oriented.
And I have definitely been in a situation where I have said to a superintendent, listen, I can send that message that you need to send without you jeopardizing your job, you know? And becoming a political animal, it's just talking to the right person, saying the right thing. In my case, I get to drop some names and I get to call in my troops, a little bit too, you know, from the neighboring clubs or whatever. Those are things that have to be done, especially in a renovation restoration type situation.
Yeah. And I've seen, you know, with Dick and Kurt at Coppin and Keebler, we do these board seminars, and Dave, it would be amazing. And what we've talked about was doing some for green committees as well. We take these seminars and this disparate group, oftentimes disparate groups of interests on a board of directors. And by the time we leave the room, they are focused and heading in one direction. And it happens over the period of a half a day. It's amazing. And it's something that I want to take out there with Coppin and Keebler and do for green committees as well. Because I think a lot of green committees could use some help in vision and direction and staying on track. So, you know, we're investigating.
I would certainly agree with that. And especially the green committees that have a lot of turnover. I mean, they just get there. They don't even really know what they're supposed to be doing. And then they're off to the next board position or whatever. And it's a bad scene sometimes for the superintendent, who's constantly re-educating everybody about why we didn't, you know, cut down that tree. Or why we should cut down that tree. Right?
Well, Dave, and the supers have to be using all those tools at their disposal. And one of the most critical ones is the golf professional. You know, they've got to be holding hands with the golf professional. They've got to have the story coming out of the shop. So when somebody walks in with a question, they've got the right answer at their fingertips. And really, you know, using all of those tools, the electric media, the written word, all of these things are important when you're going through a renovation and you need to make changes. You know, let's face it, Dave, as soon as we cut down a tree, it's the end of the world, right? and I loved what Curtis Tyrell did at Medina. Curtis, when they're going to cut down a lot of trees, you know, they did a Tom Doak renovation. It came out great on course one. Reese had done three. Reese is doing course two now. And but what Curtis did, and I thought this was just so simple and so brilliant, was he didn't put ribbons around the trees that were coming out. He put ribbons around the trees that were staying.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was so effective and so simple.
Oh, right. Right. What a great idea. Yeah, absolutely. And tells everybody what your focus really is. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, it was just wonderful, you know, and so we learn these things from others about better ways to present materials and ideas.
I agree. All right. So Armin, you've been known sometimes as a bit of a futurist, and I'd love to hear what you think of the future of the business of design.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, Dave. You know, Dick Zocal and I, being geniuses and hang our shingle up right into the recession. I don't know if my words mean much, but.
Okay. I mean, you can say that. I'm not gonna.
Yeah. Dick's probably laughing right now.
Right. Exactly. Might be just Zocal design when you get done with this.
Well, I lost. He made me the president. You know, that's the way Dick is, right?
That's not a win, exactly.
But I think as I look at the design business, there's some key phrases. You got guys like Andy Staples out there who've hit on something, and a couple others that are trying to look at the environmental sensibilities of renovations and new work as well, but it's mostly going to be renovations. For instance, in California right now, Jay Irvine, we just hired him out at Seven Oaks with, and Jay immediately looking at the water restrictions that are coming their way, you know, went out and sprayed out the Bermuda the ryegrass in some areas to show them what a targeted overseed would look like for the future. Mm-hmm. And the committee saw it and said, that's great. Let's go there. So they're going to be able to have some real irrigation savings. And so there's smart guys out there doing smart things. And I think designers have all, whether in their hearts they've embraced it or not, they certainly understand that there's revenue to be derived from some of these changes. And so I think we're going to see less and less grass and more targeted golf. And as we all know, when there is a defined target, more people are apt to hit it than when there's an expanse of green as opposed to an island of green. And by island, I don't mean too small, but we certainly...
Right, I was going to say, what island? You know, yeah, we're talking about...
60 yards or 80 yards, to me, that's an island. If we have more than that on the edges, let it go.
Right. How many heights of cut should be on a golf course?
Well, you know, we're partial to having an excess amount of fairway height. And that influences grass selections, I think, or should. And I think the average golfer and lesser golfer on an expansive short grass area is going to find themselves in the short grass quite often, if there is anything else. And the better player now has to consider which side of is the left side the right spot to be? Is the right side of the fairway? It could be 50, 60 yards different. In where the desired landing area is based upon the pin placement and the green and the surrounds, et cetera. So I think it challenges the better player because they have to think about where they want to land the ball to have the best opportunity versus the average golfer who's happy to be in the short grass for the first time in their lives.
Right. Right.
And so we like short grass and to do that and to be fiscally responsible and irrigation responsible, you have to make very good selections on the turf grass varieties and species.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is a whole nother hour that maybe you and I'll spend is talking about grass selection. Because,
we'd have to get Leah Broman in on that because she's smarter than us. Yeah.
She's smarter than all of us. And right. Yeah. Yeah. There again, you know, you get the smart people involved, and that's for sure. All right. Let's do a little bit of a lightning round here. I'm going to fire some questions at you. Ready?
Yes.
You ready to go? Okay. So, Beatles or Stones? Surfing or skiing?
Skiing.
Skiing. Longboards or shortboards for skiing?
Long. You can go faster in the bumps. Faster in the bumps.
You still bump ski?
Nah, I'm too old and decrepit. You know, the arthritis beat me to death. So
so no more of that, huh? Okay. Worst airport in America?
Chicago.
Best airport in America?
Colorado Springs right now. That's my favorite.
Colorado Springs is the best.
It's small. I can get in and out. I'd be home in 35 minutes.
Oh, okay. I got it. State that has the most potential in golf right now?
North Dakota.
Why do you say North Dakota?
I'm just having some fun. Christy, my wife is from North Dakota.
Your wife is from there.
and the western part of North Dakota has these beautiful, around the Williston area, has these beautiful, this beautiful terrain. It's just remarkable.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Let's see. I had all these, great lightning round questions and they just slipped my mind, but, favorite pro golfer right now?
Oh, I'm bandwagon, Jordan Spieth.
Jordan Spieth. And who about, who's best pro golfer of all time, dead or alive?
Oh, Jack Nicklaus.
Jack. All right. Yeah. Good answer. And, let's see, Titleist or Max Fly?
Titleist.
Okay. And, if you could go back, Armin, and start all over again, what would you do different?
Wow.
Yeah.
I really don't think I'd do it. I would have married my wife a year sooner.
Okay. All right. Smart. Smart man. I know Christy, so I know, yeah. I know the story. Exactly. Good deal. All right. Well, listen, Arm, it's been a really good thing here. Again, if you want to know a little bit more about Armin's work and all that sort of stuff, The Anarchist Guide to Golf Design, Armin Suni, Suni Zocal Design, and also with Copland and Kieber Searches. Guys are doing some great cutting edge stuff. And I would say that Armin Suni is somebody to know. From the first time that you hopped over the fence at Sol Suburban and introduced yourself, I thought, this is somebody to know. So super glad that you've been here today, Arm. Got any last
Dave,
words
thank
for
you.
Us?
Dave, thank you, and best of luck with the show. I think it's going to be a huge success for TurfNet.
Yeah, I think we're going to do some good stuff here. So you've been listening to the Renovation Report with Dave Wilbur and today's guest, Armin Suni, brought to you by Jacobson and Golf Preservations. Thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. We've got some really cool people on the hook. I don't want to give anything away yet, but my short list is looking really strong. So stay tuned on TurfNet. Follow my Twitter feed. It's at TurfGrassZealot on Twitter. And that's probably the best way to see what's going on. Thanks again, Armin. We appreciate it. Have a great day. And we'll be looking forward to talking to you again. This is Dave Wilbur, and this has been the TurfNet Renovation Report.